Today, turning back the clock, what has the COVID-19 lockdown meant for women? This week, I spoke to a number of women whose circumstances are very different. None had lost loved ones to COVID-19 and realised how lucky they were, but they all found lockdown incredibly difficult. One mother of two described how the daily phrase, "Have you finished your work yet?" would send her over the edge. Another said it was the most stressed and closest to losing it she had ever felt, as she cared for her parents, her children, and worked full-time. One, who is single and childless, felt that women like her were the forgotten people. She found the experience isolating, watching other people's busy family lives over Zoom. "No one ever said to me, 'Make sure you log off,'" she said. Two single mums also found the period scary and lonely. "It honestly felt like my head was going to explode," said one. The other, a frontline worker, barely knew how to cope as she had to continue going out to work. And then there was the one who summed it up like this: "Never felt more like a 1960s housewife and hated it." From The Guardian, I'm Anushka Astana. Today in Focus, has COVID turned the clock back on women's equality? When did you find out you were pregnant?
New Year's Eve, when I was at work.
And how did you feel about it?
I was obviously quite shocked because I didn't expect it at all.
Georgie is 35, a paramedic practitioner. She has over 11 years of professional experience, including 6 years working as a medic in the Navy. Last year, she started working for an agency who secured her a job on a rolling contract with an NHS urgent care centre. And then along comes a global pandemic. Mm. And presumably you're feeling quite vulnerable as someone who's pregnant. How did you feel about it when you knew COVID was coming?
Well, when COVID came, I already preempted that pregnant women were going to be on the vulnerable list. So I actually contacted the matron in charge to let them know that I can foresee things changing, and put in an offer to work in a different area ready. So they already had time to get things organised. I was frightened about sort of going to work and dealing with sort of general public as well, but I was already sort of preparing myself in that eventuality.
And what happened?
A couple of days after the government advice came out about pregnant workers needing to stay at home, I got a phone call from the agency to tell me that they've had to cut my contract and refuse to give me any alternative work.
But they didn't say sack people.
No, they didn't, no. I've worked full time for them. So it just baffles me that why they couldn't just allow me to work from home with the triage service, which other people were.
At any point at this stage, did you speak to your manager or go in and see them face to face?
I did speak to my agency, who told me that they don't deem it as discrimination, and they actually refused to send on a email that was sent to them via the hospital managers because I mentioned discrimination.
Tell me about the email.
It was from the hospital to the agency, which explained why they cut my work, stating due to pregnancy, they're going to have to cut my 3-month contract as of that day, as I'm not a prescriber yet, which is what I was aiming to go towards before COVID came. I won't be able to be suitable for one area, and the other area, which is what I was doing anyway in between seeing patients physically, which was a telephone triage service, which is what I was doing previously, was fully staffed according to them.
You're on a 3-month contract. Mm-hmm. When was that due to run out?
That was due to run out, I think, the end of June.
And would you have expected it to be
continued?
Was it normally continued?
Yeah. It was just rolling on.
I mean, how did you feel when you saw that email?
Well, I was in bits. I was inconsolable at the time. Ordinarily, if a locum worker, agency worker, however you want to say it, I'm an agency worker, has a contract finished or cut short, you can just go and work in another environment or another hospital or whatever. But because of COVID hitting, no one was willing to take a pregnant woman on. So all that money that I was hoping to have, or the money that I was hoping to earn, was going to support me in my maternity leave, which kind of just went. So absolutely terrifying of how I was going to pay my bills. So I contacted HR, put in a formal grievance, which was told that I wasn't able to put a formal grievance in because I'm not a full-time employee, and therefore it can only be a complaint. And then therefore I went and spoke to some people at Pregnant Then Screwed, who advised me to seek legal advice.
And in the meantime, how were you living? What did you do for money?
I wasn't eligible for universal credit because it's based on what your partner takes in as well. And I couldn't apply for job seeker's allowance because I wasn't able to apply for a job with being pregnant. By the time I got to job seeker's allowance, I was in my third trimester, so I wasn't able to really apply for a job because no one was going to be hiring me. So then I had to take disability allowance, which then came in a couple of weeks before I could take my maternity allowance.
Did you try to get other work?
Yes. Yeah, I've applied for disability assessor roles. And then I also applied for some factory jobs as well.
I'm sorry, so we're in a situation here where the NHS has let you go because you're pregnant and you're in your third trimester and you're looking for factory work and you're a trained paramedic.
Yes.
Why didn't the NHS furlough you?
Because I'm an agency worker, because I'm not on their payroll. Unless you're on PAYE, you can't be furloughed.
I'm just trying to think, is there any other schemes that apply to you? Or was there not? Essentially, you fell into that kind of freelance in between.
Yes, because I've only been self-employed for technically only just over a year. So I fall into that gap.
Gabby Hinsliff, you're a Guardian columnist and author who has written a book all about the difficulties faced in balancing work and parenting called Half a Wife. When lockdown suddenly landed, did you think then it was going to have an impact on women's equality?
I started thinking about that quite early in lockdown, really, I think. Because the thing about lockdown is it took away the prop on which sort of millions of working women's lives depend. If someone's taking care of your kids while you work, you do feel that maybe, you know, you can compete on equal-ish terms at work with people who don't have those responsibilities. But without childcare, it's like being stripped naked in public, really. You feel exposed. You have to admit there are limits to what you can do while you're simultaneously homeschooling the kids. And then you start to worry, you know, does that mean my boss will think I'm unreliable? Or if there are going to be redundancies, does that mean I'll sort of be first in line for the chop? I first wrote about it, I think, back in April, because I could tell that, you know, all the women I knew were tearing their hair out trying to work plus homeschool plus hold everything together. And it just felt as if we were going backwards. And although there was no hard data at that point, when I first wrote about it, then that column was published, suddenly my inbox filled up with academics and organisations going, actually, we're just starting a study on this, or we're just starting crunching the numbers. And I thought, OK, I'm not going mad then.
Definitely not going mad. I can remember tearing my own hair out. Despite all the progress in recent years, I mean, the stats suggest that women are very much not equal at either work or home. What was the situation coming into this crisis?
Coming into this crisis, at home, we know that women were doing on average 60% of chores and childcare versus men's 40%. And that, of course, is an average. In some houses, it will have been more. Some houses, it will have been less. We know that women were more likely to have gone part-time or work from home or sort of somehow step back professionally in order to make more time for the kids. So, of course, when the pandemic hit, you're sort of the person who seems more available or who's got time to mop up all the extra domestic stuff. We know that, although it's not true in all families, we know that men are still likelier to be the higher earner. And of course, if someone's going to take furlough or someone's job has to give in a crisis, then that's likely to be the lower earner. So, you know, we didn't approach this crisis in a sense as equals.
And how did lockdown exacerbate this situation?
when everyone was at home all the time, you know, when they're creating, and there's sort of a lot more domestic work created by that, not just entertaining the kids full time, but churning out three meals a day and all the sort of domestic and emotional admin that comes with everyone living on top of each other in fairly anxious times. You know, it was women who ended up taking the lion's share of that. The person who'd done more with the kids before kind of by default became the person who did more of that stuff during lockdown. There was a striking study, the University of Sussex did a study which found not only did 70% of mothers say that they thought they were doing the lion's share of all that stuff, but 67% of mothers felt like the default parent, which is the one the kids come to all of the time. You know, if somebody's Zoom meeting is going to be interrupted by someone wailing, then it was primarily going to be women's, and that left you with less sort of uninterrupted time to work.
You've obviously spoken to a lot of women for your reporting. You're a mum yourself who's had to carry on working through this period. How have people described how they felt during the lockdown?
Not all of that is sayable on, sayable before the watershed, I would probably say. I think it's mainly just a sense of being completely frazzled, just feeling like you're not doing, I mean, this would be something that's familiar to a lot of working mothers anyway, but the sense that you're never doing anything properly or with 100% of your attention. You're either sort of desperately trying to fob off the kids with, you know, I would not like to confess how much screen time there has been in this household over lockdown. But, you know, and then so you sort of guiltily try and compensate for that, but then you feel like you're not 100% concentrating on work. So it's that feeling of you cannot do everything simultaneously and do all of it brilliantly. And while that is, you know, lots of people's employers, including mine, I have to say, have been very forgiving about that. You know, not everybody works in an office where everyone thinks it's charming when your small child appears in a Zoom meeting, you know, and you worry about what you look like compared to other people who don't have kids and are probably managing to get even more done than usual because they're working very efficiently from home. You worry, it's the competitive aspect of it, I think, that worries people. You know, are you... You're trying to compete at work with one hand / both hands tied behind your back.
So what you're basically saying is that while COVID-19 itself as a disease disproportionately hits men, the policies around it have really been quite bad news for women. Are there figures that you found that give a broad picture of how bad it's been?
So we know that women were 1.5 times more likely than men to be furloughed, lose their job or get made redundant in the early stages of crisis. And obviously being furloughed, you know, you may come back from furlough, but when that furlough ends, it may be that some of those furloughs turn into harder redundancies. What we know at the moment, so far, is it's actually young women who were especially likely to be furloughed. A study by the HMRC found 17 was the peak age for furlough. So that's unlikely to be about having kids or not. That's more likely to be about where you work. So, you know, 36% of young women were working in sectors that were shut down by lockdown, like shops and bars and restaurants, whereas only 25% of young men were. I would say we've rightly heard a lot about younger women losing their jobs, but I think really one to watch is older women too. There was a record decrease in the last ONS figures for women over 65 working. Now, remember, pension age is going up for women now. Many can't afford to retire, you know, at 65. I think we're going to see a knock-on effect on older women too.
And obviously, the hardest thing about losing your job in the middle of a recession is that there aren't many other jobs around. And so it becomes extremely hard to get re-employed. From what we know about previous recessions, do we have any sense of what's likely to happen over the next year? Will these jobs return or could we see long-lasting effects?
I think the trouble with this recession is it's not like any other recession that we've been through, because so much depends on what happens with the virus. That determines which industries are able to stay open, which industries are able to function as normal. This time it's the service sector that's most hard hit, and that's the one that employs women. It will be really interesting to see when it comes to the end of the furlough. There've been some signals that the Chancellor might be prepared to carry on supporting some sectors even after furlough ends. You know, which ones he chooses to back and which ones he chooses not to could have a really big impact on female employment.
Let's talk about the politics, because that's been a key part of this. And when you were watching those ministerial press conferences, some of them with the Prime Minister himself, did you feel like the government realised that this could be an issue?
I think what was obvious, there was a sort of big fuss early on during those press conferences that there were no women doing those press conferences.
today, and Gavin Williamson is making a statement now in the House of Commons.
We need to ramp up the testing capacity, which will play a really important
role. One of the things I would say, just observing it, is that
until we are confident that it is a good test, because no test is better than a bad test.
And there were no women in the cabinet cord that was making the big decisions about coronavirus. And then after that, government responded by, you know, putting Priti Patel up to do a press conference on domestic violence. Obviously, you know, lockdown was held for anyone trapped with an abusive partner. And she was added to what had been the cord. But there was still a sense, a lot of Tory women MPs got very frustrated feeling that issues like childcare weren't being brought up at the press conferences. There was a feeling that female ministers and female MPs weren't really getting heard. And that really came to a head in sort of May when government first started talking about opening retail again.
We intend to allow all other non-essential retail, ranging from department stores to small independent shops, to reopen.
And yet, you know, schools and nurseries were still closed. It just didn't add up. You know, how are mothers supposed to go back to work when their kids are still at home with no one to look after them? And it just sounded like you did think, is there anyone around the cabinet table who has small children, doesn't have a nanny, and knows what it feels like to be, you know, to be living like this? The only time it really struck me, actually, was the delay in bringing back the beauty industry when everything was starting to open up. You know, it was treated as a sort of frivolous thing, you know, just silly women wanting to get facials. But it's a multi-million pound industry mainly employing women. And I just remember the PM being asked a question in Parliament by a male Tory MP. I think it was about a beautician in his constituency called Lush Beauty that wanted to reopen.
So the likes of Lush Beauty and Romilly in my constituency can reopen safely as soon as possible.
Well, Mr. Speaker, I'm sure that one day I will be going with him to Lush Beauty.
And the answer was, you know, I'm sure that one day I will be going with him to Lush Beauty, wink, wink, nudge, nudge. And everyone sort of fell about laughing. But it was a question about jobs at stake. And I know nobody desperately needs to get their nails done in a pandemic, but nobody needs to go to the pub either. And that was taken seriously as a sector of the economy that needed reopening.
That is so interesting, because actually on the very day the beauticians were allowed to reopen, they suddenly said they weren't allowed to do eyebrows, I think. And, you know, I remember seeing interviews with women who were running these organisations and just saying, we don't know if we can survive as a result of this.
And I think one of the things that really struck me is that the government declined to publish, when it was asked, the equality assessment that Liz Truss would have done as Equalities Minister on the impacts of lockdown. And that would have shown us in black and white what they did and didn't anticipate about the impacts of lockdown, not just on women, actually, but on ethnic minorities as well, because it's a broader equalities assessment.
Why didn't they produce one? Aren't they legally obliged to produce impact assessments?
They're legally obliged to produce one, but they're not legally obliged to publish one to the Select Committee, which is what they were asked to do. The reason given was that it would have a chilling effect on policymaking if it were to be published.
We don't know what is in that report, but a group of people who were definitely affected by the lockdown were those who were pregnant and giving birth. I found the stories that I heard really distressing. How much has all of this changed that experience of having a child?
I think it must have been an incredibly lonely time to be pregnant and to give birth. If you think in the height of lockdown, you know, there were women who weren't allowed to have their partners with them in labour, weren't allowed to have their partners attend scans with them. Many hospitals still aren't allowing that. Awful stories. The Tory MP, Alicia Kearns, who's pregnant herself, has been campaigning on this one. But you hear stories of women going alone to scans where they find out they've miscarried and they've got no one with them. And that just feels, you know, wrong. If you think about how vulnerable you feel in those first sort of few weeks after having a baby often, and, you know, in lockdown, people weren't able to have, you couldn't have your mum come and stay and help you out. You know, you were really on your own with the baby. I would worry that we may well have missed quite a few cases of postnatal depression during that time, you know, because nobody's seeing you.
Having lost her job, Georgie found the experience of being pregnant during this pandemic even more challenging.
Well, during my pregnancy, I was under the care of a midwifery team to support my mental health, because it took a little bit of a nosedive with everything going on.
You mentioned mental health worries. Tell me about that.
So I started suffering from anxiety shortly after all this sort of started at work. And then, yeah, I started getting quite severe panic attacks. Because every single week I was getting a new email from my solicitor with the back and forthness of what's going on with the case.
Tell me where you're at with that legal case.
So I've got my pre-hearing in November, and if they don't settle then I'm going to have to wait until 2022 for the actual tribunal.
And while all this is going on, of course, your pregnancy continued. How were you feeling as you approached the birth?
Concerned, because I was prescribed diazepam to help me with my anxiety. So I was nervous about taking that. And also there was the rules about partners not being allowed in until you're in established labour. And on top of that, I had to be induced early because I had reduced fetal movements. The baby wasn't moving as much. Not moving at all, really, which they've recorded down as a possible result of taking the very low dose of diazepam that I needed to take. I had to give birth a week early, which was very frightening.
Did the birth go okay in the end? Tell me about the baby.
Yes. So I was in labour relatively short for my first labour, 8 hours, I think it was. And he's absolutely lovely. Absolutely perfect.
What's he called?
Archie.
How's Archie?
He's lovely. He's actually a very good baby. He's quite chilled.
And how are you doing?
I'm doing all right, actually. My mood has, now that I know that I've got this, the tribunal's not till November, my mood, although I'm tired, it's improved.
How are you feeling about work going forward?
I'm in two minds at the moment of whether I want to continue my career or branch off in something else.
Wow, this has put you off potentially?
Yes, yeah, unfortunately.
Was there any question of that before?
No, I wanted to go all the way. I was on my master's degree to finish off my prescribing, my independent prescribing, and I'm due to go back on it next year. Yeah, I was hoping to continue my studying to be an advanced paramedic. But now I'm thinking of, you know, what else could I do? It's just made me go, what's the point of working so hard and going through what I've gone through to go and work for, for someone who's just going to just get rid of me like that.
Coming up, what the government needs to do to help women.
Gabby, one of the reasons to worry about female employment is because it's the right thing to do. And we're worried about women individually and their psychology and their life chances. But the other reason, the kind of hard-nosed reason to worry about it, is money for the economy. Now, arguably, this change of tone we've had around schools and the desperation to keep them open isn't only about the welfare of the kids, although clearly that is paramount, but also about helping parents and, in particular, mothers get back to work. Isn't there a financial argument for this concern to be central to policy?
There's a huge argument for treating childcare like any other kind of infrastructure, in the same way that you would assume people can't go back to work if you don't get the tube trains running. You know, it should count in the same way. Many women MPs make the point that before the pandemic started, you know, female employment was at a record high. It's been a big driver of growth in GDP over previous years. It's been a really big driver, actually, over the last decade in sort of the improvement in family fortunes. It's often, you know, the only thing that's kept people ticking over during a time when, you know, wages were really squeezed. So I do think governments learned a lesson in that sense about childcare, you know, that hence saying that schools will be the last thing to close. But if they can't sort out the testing regime, it may be very difficult to keep them open. I mean, if your kid gets a cold, you know, you can't get a test. And how are you supposed to manage in those circumstances where your child may be self-isolating for a fortnight at no notice? You know, it's a much more patchy provision, I think, than many women would like it to be. And also, you know, after school clubs and breakfast clubs often aren't open yet because schools don't want to mix their year bubbles up too much. I think the TUC produced a survey recently saying 41% of mothers of children under 10 still don't have the childcare they need.
Okay, so clearly, as you're saying, schools opening can help parents in terms of getting back to work, but it's not the silver bullet. And it also might not last. There is already talk of another lockdown. Cases are rising, hospitalizations are rising. We know that they weren't prepared back in March for the impact this would have on women. Have they learned the lessons of back then? Are they thinking about women now, do you think, when they're considering further restrictions?
I really, really hope so. That's not necessarily the same as being confident. I mean, I think there have been lessons learned. I think the sort of gaping hole at the moment is we know that in normal times, new mothers are vulnerable to being singled out for redundancy when redundancies are going around. So you'd really want to guard against that. The former cabinet minister, Maria Miller, is trying to bring in a backbench bill preventing employers from making women redundant from the point they say they're pregnant 6 months after coming back from maternity leave. So whether or not, you know, government wants to go for something like that, I think something that sends a very strong signal to employers that they shouldn't be discriminating against working mothers at that point is important. And the big one to think about, I think, that isn't really cropping up at the moment, but will do, is when the time comes to recoup sort of the costs of this pandemic, how do we do that? We know, you know, one of the reasons that women did so badly in the aftermath of the last crash is during the austerity years, you know, because if you cut benefits, women are more likely to be in receipt of benefits than men. So, you know, that impacted on women. This time round, we've got similar decisions to make. Rishi Sunak bumped up universal credit during lockdown. So is he going to keep that up or is he going to take it back down to its old level? And then a lot depends on where any tax rises or spending cuts in the wake of the pandemic fall. For example, if it's true that, you know, this time round, the government wants to balance the books by increasing taxes on higher earners, that would have a disproportionate effect on men because they're more likely to earn more. But we kind of wait to see if that's the case or not.
We all hope that things get back to normal. But in the meantime, this crisis has resulted in more women than men seeing their work lives affected. These things are hard to quantify, but I remember one stat that showed papers published by female academics fell off a cliff in 2020. And a study by University College London said women had done more hours of childcare and housework every day and were more likely to lose their jobs. Even furlough, which may have been great during the lockdown, was a period in which many women will have felt out of the loop. And to compound all of that, we now have a situation in which a quarter of nurseries are threatening to close because of financial difficulties. How worried are you about the long-term impact of this?
The worry is that it's turning back the clock, really, at a time when, you know, working women have made, over the last generation, have made huge strides forwards. You know, our lives are completely different than our mothers. And yet suddenly it's felt like being propelled back into the 1950s over this summer, you know, trapped at home, responsible for most of the childcare, responsible for most of the domestic stuff, falling behind, where you're watching people who don't have the same responsibilities kind of leap ahead of you at work. It's felt like we were being pushed back. And then you worry about whether the longer this goes on, whether that becomes kind of set in stone. You know, we never quite claw our way back to where we had been.
Gabby Hinsliff, thank you so much.
Thank you.
That was Gabby Hinsliff. I would really recommend a piece she wrote on this during the summer. You can find it at theguardian.com under the headline, "The Coronavirus Backlash: How the Pandemic is Destroying Women's Rights." Gabby's also a brilliant columnist. Do follow her work. And I mentioned her book, Half a Wife. Check it out. My thanks to her, to Georgie, and to the charity Pregnant Then Screwed, who helped us on this podcast. Before we go, I want to recommend a two-parter on our Science Weekly podcast, "Do Smart Assistants Need a Feminist Reboot?" which is all about why virtual assistants are so often characterised as female and what that means for gender stereotypes. It's presented by our UK technology editor and a Today in Focus favourite, Alex Hearn, who we do love and who will be presenting more regularly. That's it for today. This episode was produced by Elizabeth Cassin. Sound design was by Axel Cucoutier. The executive producers are Nicole Jackson and Phil Maynard. We'll be back tomorrow.